Good morning to Kyle Beis HaTalmud. I think this is the first time we'll be doing the Skype Shiur standing. And it's a great kavod for me to introduce Rabbi Moshe Perlmutter Shlita, who is one of the biggest experts in the OU staff on kashering. And without further ado, I'd like to call Rabbi Perlmutter.
First of all, Brishus, Rabbi Wurzberger, Rosh Kollel, and the Chasher V'Chevrei Kollel, Beis HaTalmud, thank you for letting me speak. I saw on the flyer it spoke, mentioned...
You should make him to make mute. I think you have to make mute. No? Yeah, because they...
Okay. I see on the flyer, besides industrial kashering, it mentioned home kashering. I usually speak about what I call food service kashering, which is hotels, nursing homes, hospitals, catering, weddings, dinners, things like that. I actually did not have a lot of experience in home kashering because I was, for 15 years, I was at a Pesach hotel. So the last 5 years, Baruch Hashem, I have been home, so I've had to kasher an actual home kitchen. obviously, the halachas are the same, whether it's industrial kashering in a factory, the metzias is different. There are a lot of similarities and some differences. I'll try to point them out. Please feel free to ask questions. And okay, so the first I want to give a basic overview of kashering. I know a lot of this you might know, and just in order not to leave anything out, so I apologize. Anything's basic, it just will help me cover ground, and then I will try to go into some industrial kashering. So when I talk about catering, especially, but all kashering, I always point out there's five, I categorize it as five methods of kashering. Hagala, Iri Kli Rishon, third is Libun Kal, then Libun Gomor, Libun Chomor, and my favorite is the fifth category is No, it cannot be kashered, which is a very important point. A lot of times, especially on a catering job, caterers, it's a very high-pressured atmosphere and people will grab things, please kosher this. And there, hopefully you'll see there are certain items that cannot be koshered and you have to be able to know to say no. Okay, some of the basics which apply to all the types of koshering is the most important. Everything has to be spotless, has to be clean, more so with Hagalah than Libun. If there's a little, the end, something left over, Libun, especially Libun Gomer, you'll burn it off. We want to make sure any rust, if we're doing Hagalah, is gone. The other most important thing besides cleanliness is that you must know how the piece of equipment was used in order to know how you should kosher it. This is very, very nogeya in a factory, but even in your own home, or even in a hotel. If a caterer says, can you kosher a gooseneck, and you have no idea, or an escoffier, and all these words you never heard of, you won't know if you could kosher it. So this is a gooseneck. It's used to put sauce in it. So this is something that we would do Hagalah on. And the other thing about kashering, besides knowing how each piece of equipment is used, like I said, it's very important that you should know how it's used. And let me just now, go through very quickly some of the things. Hagalah, Like I said, Eino ben Yoima. Now we're going to in a hotel. We usually have something called a steam kettle. I'm going to describe that more. It's a large pot that's heated through steam, and that's what we use to dip the utensils in. To kosher that actual kettle to use for cooking is more challenging. There's something, if the hotel has a return steam system, or that means the steam that's heating, after it heats up the whatever in that kettle, it's going to return to the boiler, the condensate. And now, if they used it yesterday, or if they're using it, a kettle, you know, 10 feet away for something treif, so now the steam and everything coming out of that boiler is going to be treif. So some factories, we add a dovra poigim to the boiler system. Other places, they do not have a return system where you can have the condensate drop down the drain. So to kosher the kettle to actually use for cooking is a much bigger challenge. So when we go into a hotel to kosher for kosher, let's say silverware, we'll use the kettle, make sure it's as clean as possible, and then we'll add a dover poigim. Usually we use ammonia, which because it doesn't change the actual look of the water, so it's not considered a shar mashkim, and therefore any bliyas that are coming from that steam will not affect what you're koshering. And that's whether your silverware or your items that you're koshering are eino ben yoimer or not. Even if they're an eino ben yoimer, still you would need a dover poigim in the kettle to prevent the bliyas from the kettle from retrafing up your equipment. So again, Hagala, there's many, many different ways. You could actually fill up a basket, which in Tuflin base sets, brings down in Hilchas Pesach. By the way, I'm sorry. Most of these halachas that I'll reference are in the Hilchas Pesach. Chelek Hay, Tuflin Aleph, and Tuflin base. Also, Yeridei, Kuchav Aleph. So in Tuflin base, it mentions that you could put everything in a basket and then dip it in. That way the water could, boiling water could reach everything. It also mentions that you should not put too many kalim in at once, because they'll be pressing down on each other and the bliyas won't be able to come out. So if you have a lot of silverware, now when we do a function where there's a reception, we figure 3.5 forks per person. If you have a wedding of 700 people, multiply that times 3.5, and then 2 forks, 2 spoons, 2 knives, 3 knives. You're talking about thousands and thousands of pieces of silverware that you're koshering. So to do 1 or 2 pieces in a basket at a time is very impractical. So what most people do is that when the basket is submerged, they'll shake it under the water a few times to make sure that it's not sitting on each other. Method I like is to put the basket in the water first, and then as you're checking the pieces of silverware to make sure they're clean, you could drop them in the basket one by one, so each piece is going to be flowing through the boiling water without anything else touching it. It's also brought down that you could use a pliers. You can actually take the kli that you're koshering and dip it in the water that way. Of course, it says you need to then grab it from a second spot and re-dip it, because the spot that the pliers were touching will not have been kosher. That will be a chatzitza. Obviously, safety is a major concern, so we have special koshering gloves that, these are electrician gloves that can withstand the temperature, not for a very long time, but you can immerse your hand. You have to be careful, you don't put your hand in too far and let the glove fill up. Unfortunately, I speak from experience. And Just like the pliers, you should have to now grab it from a different point. So if you were using the gloves and holding a keli and dipping it in, so then you would, then with your other hand, you would reach the spot where your glove is. It could be that if the gloves are wet and you're holding it loosely, then that really wouldn't be a problem. But it's easier to hold it, you know, just grab with the second hand. You could also just drop them into the kettle, and if you have a lot of things to do, and then just drain the water at the end and then fish them out afterwards. Again, if you're koshering for a whole day, that's also not so practical. There's certain other things that might be a challenge. This is an old coffee pot. Again, the lid is on hinges, so if you were to just drop this in the water, it might bob upside down with an airspace. So that would be a problem. So while you're koshering this, I would actually hold it on an angle, half submerge, let the water fill up, and then with my other hand, reach under the water, grab the handle as I'm pouring it out to make sure that the whole interior of the coffee pot got koshered. Another problem with Hagala, getting back to saying, being able to say no, that certain things you can't kosher, is the rim. If there's a rolled edge around here, I don't know if you can see that. If there's a rolled edge, so you can't see inside, you cannot see inside to know if there's any be'en there. So one solution would be to use a torch, do liblin along the edge, and then anything that would be there would be burnt out, and then you could do hagala. Of course, if you use a torch, you'll see, I don't know if you can see it discolored, that's what happens, so you can't do that in a hotel or somewhere and damage other people's equipment or property. Of course, this particular pot I'm showing just has a plastic handle. So if you were to kosher this, it's two different pieces of material. So just like a knife has unless they do have a one-piece metal, but if it's a plastic handle, then we can't kosher it. We're afraid there might be be'en stuck between where they meet. So this one you could actually unscrew and then kosher both pieces separately. And then you would be able to do hagal on this. Another problem is napa, a strainer. They have different types in commercial kitchens, a colander, a China cat, different types of strainers. Where if there's small holes, then you are not able to do hagala because we're afraid, even though it looks clean, but there might still be dirt stuck in those fine holes, and therefore you wouldn't be able to kosher it with regular hagala. What you could do, again, if it's not a problem of damaging or discoloring, if you're not worried about that, then you could use a torch, go over the holes, burn out anything that's there, and then do hagala on the rest. Iri Kli Rishon, again, I'm going through this quick, is you're pouring boiling water. Most of the time, you're doing it on a table or on sinks. So Iri, unlike Hagala, the surface that you're pouring the water on needs to be dry. We're worried that if you pour water, the boiling water may Iri on the table and there's already water there, so that water is going to cool off the may Iri. Also, the Kli has to be a Kli Rishon. So again, if you're taking a pitcher and dipping it in the boiling water and then pouring it, so now the pitcher is a Kli Sheni. So you need to hold it in the water for around 10 seconds. It says until you see the bubbles come out of that actual pitcher, then that will have a din of a Kli Rishon. This is brought down in the Mishnah Berurah. It's 100% L'chatchila Kli Rishon now. This is similar, the same concept as your chicken soup serving on the Hilcha Shabbos. You leave the ladle in the soup, the ladle could become a Kli Rishon then, because it's in the soup, and then when you go to your soup bowl, it will be Iri Kli Rishon instead of a Kli Shlishi that you might have been hoping for. So the other halacha by Iri is that Lo Nifsach HaKiluach. So if I'm pouring water from the pitcher on the table, I can't just splash it onto the table. I have to make sure that at all times it's connected from the pitcher to the table. So you start pouring, and before you move, you make sure it's connected, and then you go back and forth over the area. Now, I know a common question is, I had just said that the surface has to be dry, but now you're going to go back, you did half of a table, or part of a table, you have to go back, fill it up again, your pitcher, and go a second time. So the water that you just poured a minute ago, that is not a problem. You're also going to want to overlap, just to make sure. You should do it in a methodical way. Go back and forth so you make sure you don't miss any spot. Also in a sink, since to minimize make it more optimal that you're doing it on a dry surface, I would do the bottom of the sink first, then I would move to the sides and then the top surrounding area. Okay, Lieblen Kahl. So there's two types of Lieblen Kahl. One is without a direct flame. That's the method we usually kosher an oven with. When we go into a hotel, is just making sure it's clean. We turn the oven on to the highest temperature, hopefully over 500 degrees. Again, the different shiurim, you could refer to the handouts. I'm not sure if you have the temperatures, but Rabelski holds there's a sliding scale. So if your oven doesn't go to full 525 degrees, it only reaches 450 or 475. So if you keep burning longer, so that will also be good. And you could look at that sliding scale. Again, that's without a direct flame. If you're doing a Lieblen Kahl with a direct flame with a torch, then it's a much lower temperature that you would need. What we also do is in the ovens, they have shelves, we call them racks, and side pieces, both as a mila and halacha, and also as just as a shortcut for time cleaning. We like to burn those racks on top of the stove. We line them up neatly on the stovetop, cover it with silver foil. Then the heat coming up will be reflected back down. It gets trapped in there, and usually all the grease will burn off it. It's definitely preferable to clean the bigger grease off. Also, underneath the burners in the stove, under the stove, gabi kashrus, it doesn't bother us if there's any grease, chazer fat. It doesn't matter what's underneath the flame. But if you're going to be doing this, burning out the racks, you'll want to clean out underneath so you don't cause a grease fire. Because when the flame is reflected back down and all that heat, it's going to continue going underneath the burners, and any buildup of grease under there could catch on fire. One very important thing is before you start koshering in a kitchen is, with any type of fire on the stovetop or with a torch, first look around, make sure there's a fire extinguisher. Not only that there's a fire extinguisher, but make sure it didn't expire. Sometimes people might use it and put it back, and that's when you have a fire in the kitchen, that is not a good time to first find out that the fire extinguisher is used up. Also bring small fire extinguishers with me in my koshering bag just in case. That's as a backup. If I'm doing a larger job, I'll bring a larger fire extinguisher with me besides what they have at the hotel. As I mentioned, the Lieblen Kahl for the oven, of course, there's other ovens, like a pizza oven, that would need a Lieblen Gummer. Anything that has direct contact with the surface of the oven, but you need a Lieblen Gummer. A lot of people say they kosher an oven with a blowtorch. I'm talking about the regular convection oven or a home oven. I personally feel that if someone attempts to kosher an oven with a blowtorch, that not only in order to get a Lieblen Gummer, not only did they probably not get a Lieblen Gummer, they probably did not even get a Lieblen Kahl. If they went anywhere near the thermostat, they'll ruin the thermostat. It would need to be replaced. By turning on the oven at the highest temperature, you're assured that every last spot absorbed that heat. Of course, you can go over small spots if there's any be'en that you're having difficulty taking off. I know Rabbi Grossman wanted me to show a lot of different equipment. So these are some of the small torches I have. In America, the blue tanks are propane and the yellow tanks are map gas. MAP, map gas, is a little hotter than the propane. This one has a fairly large flame. This is a smaller torch, comes apart. You can take in your koshering bag. If you're koshering a sink with Eru, you could go in the corners first. If you're other small things, you could use. You can see here the smaller flame. So these would be good to, again, if there's little spots in the corner. This one has a hose that you could be able to hold in any angle and get into tighter spots with. Again, we want to see Kash Nisra with the direct flame. You can refer to the sheet of what that actual temperature might be. One of the things about a blowtorch, and let me just show you now. Again, we have, let's say, a regular barbecue tank is a 20-pound tank of propane. We would attach this regulator. I have a 16-foot hose here. And then this is what's a roofer's torch, which had quick disconnect. And then this would have a very large flame. You could cover a larger area, but then again, it's also more dangerous if you're doing a table or some large piece of equipment. Just last night, I did a kashrut for Pesach already, a meat producing, a place that produces hot dogs, salamis, corned beefs. So they have different rods that the hot dogs, if you ever seen hot dogs being produced, they're actually tied in a chain and they hang from these rods. So does kishka. Kishka, which has breadcrumbs, which would be chametz. So I actually used a torch. In the past, I've used charcoal. And again, you have to be very careful with that torch. Okay, charcoal, it's going back to the pizza oven. So charcoal is what I feel. I mentioned that if doing with a blowtorch, a whole oven is very difficult to hold it, the torch in one place for the proper amount of time, and then make sure you don't miss any spots without ruining the oven. If you ignite charcoal and then put it when it's at the proper temperature and spread it out, you could actually move it aside. This is my charcoal shovel. You can see it's burnt a lot. And I use this with special gloves. These are gloves for a dry heat. I use them with charcoal. Also have these are actual fireman gloves. They're not as long to protect you, but you could touch something much hotter than the other gloves with. So you can move the charcoal around to different areas and hold it there, and that's a much more effective way of koshering a large piece of equipment and ensuring that you have a proper libun chamor. Just to mention, I koshered once, it was a few years ago here in Manhattan, a pizza oven, a small pizza store. There was a trafe store going kosher. I think it ended up, it's not kosher anymore after like 3 years. And I wasn't going to bring my large torch. I just brought the small torches. I wasn't going to bring charcoal. In Manhattan, there's no backyard or loading dock or anything. It would have just been the sidewalk. So I couldn't do all those methods. In the pizza ovens, they have stones. So one thing, we could have taken them out and brought them outside, but then again, like I said, I couldn't do that on the sidewalk in Manhattan. So I had to come up with another way of koshering this pizza oven. And so I'll tell you, the reason why I was so worried is this particular restaurant, pizza shop, was in the lobby of the Empire State Building. And I told people I could think of, better ways of becoming famous than being the person that burnt down the Empire State Building. So what I ended up coming up with is I had the owner of the pizza shop have the repair service person for the oven come, and they removed the thermostat. It's on a long wire, and they pulled it outside the door of the oven. Now when you turn on the oven, there's nothing from stopping it. The thermostat, when it reaches temperature, it'll stop the temperature, and then when it goes down lower, it'll start up again. Here it just kept pumping out the heat. I have an infrared thermometer here. It actually has a red dot, and you can aim it at a distance, and it'll tell you what temperature, and I actually got between 900 and 1,000 degrees without any charcoal, without any blowtorch, just from its own heat by removing the thermostat. I was still very nervous about the ductwork in case there was grease up there. If there was a fire there, it would be beyond my reach to put it out. But Baruch Hashem, it was only 200 degrees, the ductwork, and I guess, you know, pizza ovens are made to maintain the heat. Retain the heat, so therefore there was no problem. Okay. Okay. So before I talk, what Eric Grossman wanted me to mention about industrial koshering, just the other thing I just wanted to mention, which is I see is abused many times, especially with this large torch. But even with the smaller torches, is, I like to say, it's not a magic wand. I've seen many people use the torch, especially when you see a flame that shoots out literally 2 feet, and it's a very intense flame. I was once at a factory with a dual hashgacha, and the other hashgacha, whatever, they kashered a table. I noticed there was still the sticker on the table from the auction. It was bought used, and it was a little browning, but I saw if it was kashered at the proper temperature, it wouldn't, there would be more damage to that sticker, or it would be totally consumed. So the Rav Machshir came down, and his mashgiach sat there with the torch, just like this, and then he went to move on to the next part. The other Rav Machshir put his hand down and was able to hold his hand on the spot that the mashgiach thought was already properly koshered. So obviously it wasn't even Yad Seletus, even though you had this huge flame. It takes time for the metal to absorb the heat. You don't want to hold the torch in one place in order for it to absorb all that heat, because then metal will warp and you'll end up with a table that has these little bumps in it. So you want to wave back and forth over a large area and slowly bring up the temperature over a large area. Now, the point of this story is, like I said, it's not a magic wand and it's not guesswork. So how do you know? So, like I said, we have the infrared thermometer is very good for very high temperatures, especially with charcoal, things like that, but it's not as accurate as other ways of measuring temperatures. There's also a problem, certain metals will reflect differently and it will change the reading, the outcome, because of emissivity. It's a whole technical thing with metals, but this is a very handy thing because you could measure temperature from all the way across the room. You don't have to get as close to what you're measuring. We also have something called temp sticks or temperature sticks, temple sticks. They're different brand names. Everything in the Bria has its own melting point. So each of these sticks that I have, this one says 800 degrees Fahrenheit. I apologize for not knowing all the Celsius conversions. This is 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which would definitely be a Liebengummer. This is 700. So each of these crayons, this is 500, are made of different materials that... let's say the 1,000 degree. If the material is 999 degrees and I rub this on the surface, nothing will happen. As soon as it hits 1,000, it'll just flow like a liquid. So these are for welders, and it's good for koshering, just to get a feel, not to measure every spot, but just to get a feel how long you need to hold the torch on that particular gauge metal to know how long it will take to absorb. Okay, so now just to save time for questions at the end, I'm going to speak about a maisa in industrial koshering. Okay. So in industrial kashering, you can encounter many types of equipment. Some of them are more complicated, like spray dryers, homogenizers, votators, heat exchangers, vacuum pans, and deep fryers. By the way, we don't kasher the OU, and most hashgachas have followed suit, do not kasher a regular deep fryer in the kitchen. We'll do industrial ones if they take it apart. We found, actually a friend of mine brought this Metzias to Ravelsky, showed him that there's a double wall, and in the inside wall was caked on with grease. And there's a spot you couldn't see and couldn't access unless you turned the whole fryer upside down. You really wouldn't assume, or we didn't for years assume, that anything could get in that spot, but the grease was able to get in, but we weren't able to get the grease out. So the inside of the fryer, let's say this clears the fryer, even though it's a challenge to clean that, but even if you got it spotless, it would be like koshering this pot with grease still all on the outside. So, and then it had a double wall, so you couldn't see that the outside part of the kli of the deep fryer was impacted with grease. So these are some of the more difficult types. So I'm going to attempt to illustrate to you the many difficulties that could arise during koshering even a basic piece of equipment. I mentioned before a steam kettle. So a steam kettle is very similar to a soup pot that you might have at home. Right? The soup pot is heated on the flame of the stove, on the stovetop. Now, a kettle, a steam kettle in a hotel or in a factory is much larger than your soup pot. Let's pretend this is a soup pot. So at home, you're heating from underneath a small flame. If you have a large pot, it will never heat up such a large thing with just a flame on the bottom. So they invented what's called a steam kettle, which has a jacket, a double wall all around, and the steam will circulate. So now you have a heat source not only from the bottom, but also all around the sides. Sometimes it only goes halfway up, but it's encompassing a much larger area than the flame on the bottom would do. It's mostly, as it's called, a steam kettle, usually steam inside that hollow space or a jacket. Sometimes it's hot water. Okay, so to kasher the steam kettle, you have to, again, make sure it's clean, just like your pot, your soup pot. Wait 24 hours, ensure that it's an Eino Ben Yomer. Fill it up with water, and then once it boils, make sure it overflows over the edges, and that's how you kasher it. Now, water boils at atmospheric pressure at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 100 Celsius. That one I know, that's an easy one. So at home, when you're koshering something in a pot, you don't need to measure to make sure it's at 100 Celsius or 212 degrees. You could see the bubbles, and you know that it's boiling. There are many times in factories where either it's not practical or it's impossible to measure the temperature, to see the bubbles that are boiling, and therefore you would actually need to measure the temperature. Okay, there's also some problems. I want to just a little hakdama. One problem, koshering such a steam kettle in a factory, is there's something called direct steam injection. So till now we were talking about steam in a jacket along the sides. Direct steam injection is they actually take a steam hose or pipe and it's placed into the actual product or the water you're trying to boil. Now, as opposed to the jacket, which doesn't have any physical contact and it's only along the outer sides. Now, when you inject steam directly into the tank, it's similar. I'm sure you've seen young children, if you have a straw and you're drinking chocolate milk and the child blows into the straw, so you're going to have bubbles. So too, the steam injection is going to cause bubbles inside the water. So someone who's not as experienced in industrial koshering might think that those bubbles is an indicator that it's already boiling. Another possible reason for confusion could be water overflowing from the top of a tank. So when water is heated, it expands. When you have a large volume of water, you have a larger amount of expansion, and more water will be flowing over the top. And this will happen before it reaches 100 Celsius. So you could have water overflowing the top, and if you didn't know what you were looking at, you might think that that's an indicator that the kettle is already boiling. Okay, so now the story. A number of years ago, I was sent to a plant to kosher a tank, and this tank held around 40,000 gallons of water. Okay, the top of the tank was completely enclosed, and there was a small glass window on the top that you were able to look in to make sure it's clean. I went up, looked with a flashlight, and I could see that it was clean. This was before they filled it with water. To reach this window on top, I had to climb up a set of metal stairs to a catwalk almost two stories high for this 40,000 gallon tank. Okay. After I checked that it was clean, they started filling up the tank. Now it took between 3 and 4 hours just to fill it up with water. That's without actually heating it. Okay. They turned on the steam jacket, which surrounded the majority of the walls, the sides, and the bottom. And because it was such a large volume, they also put a direct steam injection on the bottom of the tank. Normally where the product would exit, the outlet, it's called, they hooked up a steam hose. So now we had steam actually in directly into the water with direct steam injection and circulating around the sides. Okay. They also had pipes on the top, and they, what we called hard piped, where different ingredients or water will enter into the tank, and they removed one of them so there would be an opening so we could see the water coming out the top. And this is around a 2-inch diameter opening. So after several hours of waiting for this to boil, the supervisor pointed to a gauge and showed me this gauge, a temperature gauge, and he showed me that it read 215 degrees Fahrenheit, which would be over, let's say, 102 degrees Celsius, and trying to convince me that the tank, the water was already boiling. So what he didn't know is during the day, as I was waiting for the tank to heat up and boil, I had a schmooze with one of the workers, and I asked him, you know, what's this, what's that? Very important you ask as many questions as you can. Even if you know the answers, you might learn something new. And he told me that that temperature, a thermometer, that gauge measured the jacket temperature. And I followed the cord and I verified that that was what it was. There happened to have been two other gauges. One was a digital readout, which wasn't hooked up. Another one, or it was broken, and the other one was not calibrated properly. So, at the time that, remember, when I turn on the steam in this empty jacket, very shortly after, the jacket is going to be, in Fahrenheit, around 200, steam is 220 degrees. So that, around 108 degrees Celsius, in the jacket, now, way before the water comes to a boil. So anyway, at the time that the supervisor was trying to prove to me that the water is boiling and we could all go home, it was actually only 140 degrees. Now, how do I know this? So again, that's why I've been stressing the importance of being able to measure things. So this is what's called a thermocouple. It's a digital thermometer. It has different probes, different attachments that you could plug into it. And this one I was able to put it at the top of the tank. Now remember, there were bubbles because there was direct steam injection. It was overflowing from the top because the water was expanding. But it was only 140 degrees Fahrenheit, which I don't know the math offhand of Celsius, but way under 100 Celsius at the time. So, finish that story. That supervisor ended up going home. He couldn't wait any longer. And was around 6:30 at night, 9.5 hours after I arrived at this plant, it finally started to boil. We're able to make it overflow and finish kasher. So, just to illustrate how you need to be able to measure yourself, not rely on gauges. A lot of times the gauges, even without someone trying to trick you, a lot of times the gauges might not be accurate. It's also important to know, like I mentioned before, kashering, you can have a tank that in one factory has a steam jacket or has a steam line going to it. Another tank factory might have that same looking tank, but instead of steam, it could be a cooling coil with cold water. So you need to understand every pipe entering and exiting the tank in order to be able to know if you have any kashrus issues, in order to know how to kasher it. So just like in the hotel, but more so by industrial kashering, it's very important to know how that's used. Another thing about factories, when you're in a hotel, in a catering thing, everything is hands-on. You're putting on these gloves, you're dipping all the silverware in the water, you're holding the torch. In a factory, most of the time, it's not hands-on, and you will not be touching anything. So usually this is due to safety concerns, either or insurance regulations, or I don't know if they have in Australia unions, but it's very big here, especially in New York. The union, if you're not in a certain job, they won't let you do something. I try to get them to let me, you know, do hands-on anyway by telling them I'm with the Orthodox Union. When that ploy doesn't work, so your job in a factory is to watch the workers do the actual koshering, and your job is to ensure that it's done properly and to direct them on what they should do. Another problem with a factory is if something breaks, whether it's your fault or not, they're going to blame you. So besides, obviously, the financial part problem of this, it's also, there's a halacha, in Tufman Aleph, Sif Katan Zion, that says, Dil Machayas Alayhu. We know by Cheres certain things that if you kosher it at a certain temperature, it might break. So therefore, we're not allowed to kosher it in the first place, because Chazal were afraid you might not leave it in long enough in the boiling water, or you might not kosher it at the proper temperature. I always say that that's one of my favorite halachas. I always quote when I speak. If anyone remembers the Mishnah Berurah there, it says, Dil Machayas Alayhu. Mishnah Berurah, the Mechaber brings down Asuyas Mikaren, something that's made from horn. You can't kosher it because it would be ruined. We're afraid it'll get ruined in the boiling water. But the Mishnah Berurah brings down Ha'asuyas mi perl muter. You can see why it's one of my favorite halachas. Kivin shu kasha ma'od ain lachosh. So because it's a very hard material, we don't have to worry, and you can kasher perl muter, which is mother of pearl. So this halacha, besides cheres or other items, different glass, would, I believe, apply even in a factory or a piece of equipment that's very expensive. If you're hesitant to kasher a piece of equipment because it might break, then maybe you shouldn't be koshering it or shouldn't be allowed to kosher it. So what we have, Gross reminded me, I believe it was Rabbi Dov Schreier in the food service division, made a release form, which I don't know if halakhically it helps, but we have a release form telling them that we are about to kosher your place. The equipment we're koshering was not meant to be brought to the temperatures that we're going to bring it to. We're going to try our best not to ruin anything, but if something breaks during the koshering process, that we're not liable. So that does take some of the, you know, worry off of you while you're koshering that that item. Thank you. So, just another if you have a commercial bakery, you can have a tunnel oven. That means cookies are formed. The dough is dropped onto a belt, a series of belts transferred one to another, and it finally goes on an oven band. This oven band could be 300 feet long. It could be a 150-foot oven that's, you know, goes around. And by adjusting the temperature and the speed of the oven band, it enters the oven. By the time it comes out, it's perfectly cooked. It gets cooled off and then packaged. So to kosher an oven band, which is has direct contact, you would need to bring the oven band to 900 to 1,000 degrees. And a 300-foot oven band is very expensive if you damage it. It's either made of a mesh link or a thin metal that's perforated, and it's bringing up to high temperature could even stretch it a little, and then it won't work properly. So these are some of the instances where you would need to be very careful and worry about Dilma Chaya Shamapaki. One thing, some of the other things I didn't show. We have, these are basic thermometers that a chef would use in a kitchen or in a factory. You could, these are adjustable. If you could calibrate it. Certain factories I go to, the quality control, they check everything and they calibrate. You put this in boiling water, make sure if it's Celsius at 100, you can put it in ice water, make sure it's at zero, and that's how you know. And this one has a little nut, you could move it to calibrate it. But if you have a huge kettle of boiling water, you can't put your hand near there because it could splash up at you. That's why one of the other ones I showed you with the longer probe would be more more efficient, more safer. Another thing I have, these are called temperature dots. They're little stickers. You could also buy them rated at different temperature. And when you stick this to the side of a kettle and it reaches the temperature that's listed there, the center will turn black. Again, someone one of the workers in a company told me that someone was using this, and when, I think it was an inspector, I don't think it was a kashrus issue, and when the inspector wasn't looking, someone took out a cigarette lighter and heated it up to make it turn black. So you would want to make sure no one does that for these. One of the challenges, in industrial kashering is the cleaning. It's going to be a lot. If you have a pot if you have a pot like this in a catering hall, it's very easy to tell whether it's clean or not. This is just a collection of pipes, different parts that I put together. This is what you would see in a factory. I told you to add a pipe going into that kettle. That would be a pipe like this. And these are all clamped together. You can open them up. So, like, here you have a T. This could be capped if they don't need this. Right? This could be capped. This could go one way. You have three directions. If they don't need this, it could be capped. Now, when they're cleaning it, whatever the end was stuck in here might not come out. So you would need to open this up, rinse it out, and then cover it again. Another question I came up with is, this is called a sight glass. Because this is stainless steel and you can't see, there's certain times where the workers need to see if the product is flowing through the pipes. So they have a small section of glass. So my question was, which was addressed to both Rav Belsky and Rav Schechter, and I believe you have a copy, that's the tshuva. This is what it's referring to, the sight glass. So again, you could read the tshuva and you could see why this is not a problem, even though we do not kosher glass. But for this small piece and for the reasons given, this would not be a problem in a factory and we would be able to kosher it. So besides all these pieces, you then have different valves which will open and close. You have three-way valves. Again, this is placed a place where Be'en could get stuck, and you need to know if you're sending the water through, open and close the valve a few times maybe to make sure there's nothing stuck in there. And every once in a while you would be actually breaking open one of these connections and taking it apart and then looking inside. They also then have a gasket that goes between, and you would spot check in the factory. Now a factory could have miles, literally miles and miles of pipes, you know, similar to this, and you would need to spot check and make sure that's clean. So if anyone has any questions now, I apologize, I was jumping over all over. I don't know how order it was. But if anyone has any questions, is it still muted?
Yeah, they're muted on that.
They're unmuted. Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, now we can.
Okay. How many spot checks do we need to make?
That's that all depends on. On each individual situation. I have a margarine factory that I go to, and there are different times throughout the over 20 years that I've been going there where I found the mehagala had be'en in it or it was oily. If you're doing anything with oil, you'll be able to see the water floating. There was a time where every time I went to kasher, there was stuff coming out. We discovered it was in the valve. So we worked and had them take apart the valve before I got there. Then I would check it, and then they would put it back together. And until they devised a cleaning system, and if you work with them, devise a cleaning system, the proper chemicals, until now we see that the water is coming out clear, and then I could tell that they've tackled the problem and there's no more the end there. The boiling water will most likely loosen up anything in the pipes. I can't tell you once a year, twice a year, there's no magic number. Okay.
Is it necessary to use the Eben Malubin when kashering a sink with Eroi?
Oh, so that's a very good question. Again, in a commercial, I apologize that I don't usually do kashering in homes, which is probably more nogeya to all of you. You want to kasher your own sink for Pesach. In a factory, for sure not, or even in a catering hall, it's very impractical. Some of the you mentioned a sink, but even a table, it's very impractical to do an Eben Malubin. What I do sometimes, again, Eben Malubin is taking away the chasarin, of Defanos Makaros, that the walls, the metal surface is going to cool off your May Iri. So what I do is I heat up the sink with a blowtorch. I do that first, and then I'll pour the Iri, and that will have the din of a full Hagala. Again, it's not Mi Ikar Hadin. I really don't want to, I'm not here to paskin, but it does say Nogim, that we're noyed to do that. Again, I don't want to go into the actual halacha, but in a commercial setting, we'll use a blowtorch. Now, you might ask, or people have asked me, once I'm using the blowtorch, why don't I just kasher with the blowtorch? So that'll go back to my whole theory on the magic wand. In order to get a proper libun kal with a blowtorch of a sink, it's very easy to damage it. But to heat it up, to take away the chasarin of Defanos Makaros, and then do Irui, so then I feel much more comfortable doing that.
Okay. 10 degrees Fahrenheit several times during this year. Why does Hagola have to be this high?
You said 212?
No, why have to be 1,000 degrees?
Oh, no.
What? By
Libun Gomer, again, none of these, Libun Gomer or Libun Chomer is, right, Nitzitzitz Nitzin. So when you actually see sparks flying off the metal, or if you see it glowing bright red. Now, usually, the metals we have today, you're 99% of the time, you'll almost never see actual sparks unless you're doing something made out of cast iron or some type of metal like that. You'll actually see the sparks. So obviously, the temperatures weren't given, but we see when something's turning bright red, that's the temperature, so therefore we look at that temperature. But again, every situation is different. When I had to do certain oven bands, I was told that we could, by Pesach, that we could, if we get the oven band to a temperature of over 700-800 degrees without a direct flame, and then apply the direct flame to it as the band is exiting the oven, then that would be enough. Self-cleaning ovens, people ask, you know, where does this temperature, how do we know a self-cleaning oven is considered a Liebum Gomer? Again, I just saw, I believe it was Rabelsky was quoted, that the shame, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, Zichron Levracha, and other Poskim from his time, that you see that the self-cleaning oven accomplishes what a Liebum Gomer is supposed to accomplish, and therefore high temperature and that longer period of time will also be a Liebum Gomer. So I'm not saying that you need 1,000 all the time. Again, you have to ask different Poskim, but I was referring to only Liebum Gomer, not a Liebum Kal at that point.
Does the OU follow the Aruch Shulchan's Psak? You can use laboratory testing to verify that there's no Be'en on the machine.
There are certain times, I'll tell you, in around 25 years of me doing this, once we had to rely on that with a certain reactor. It was a very complicated piece of equipment. They actually brought in a water drill to drill out the end that was stuck in this tall column. And afterwards, because it was impossible to see, they actually did a laboratory test to see what parts per million, and again, the Poskim decided what threshold that was. And that was, again, once in 25 years that I personally, with the OU, had to rely on that. So I guess your answer is yes.
One last question.
When you capture in a stovetop and you put a breath on, how do you ever get to the one gamor over there to kasher?
Okay, so the actual stovetop, Rav Moshe held that it's pretty much self-kashering, which means that in your home, if anything would spill on the burner grates, it would be burnt off from the open flame. Now, unfortunately, that metzias in a commercial kitchen, it's a lot dirtier and there's so much more volume of spill. I wish it would be all burnt out, but instead you need to clean it. But again, it does not lead a Liebum Gomer because you're not putting food directly on it, you're putting a pot on it. And we have halacha, shnei kelim noigazu bazu. The blia can't transfer from one dry metal surface to another. So if the stovetop was perfectly clean, even if it was treif, and you put on a perfectly clean pot on top of it, there would be no transfer of blias. A grill, though, that you do put meat, let's say hamburgers, steaks, directly on it, that would need a Liebum Gomer. That I would do, I actually take the grills in the kitchen are made up of smaller pieces, and I usually take one or two at a time, put them over two burners, cover it with silver foil, like I described earlier, until I get a Liebum Gomer. Now, another little trick in a kitchen, you're looking, if you don't have the infrared thermometer, you're looking for it to glow red. Sometimes if you turn off the lights in the kitchen, you'll see it glowing much quicker than if you wait, you know, with the lights on, and you'll see that it actually is glowing. And if you have an infrared thermometer, you could see that it will actually reach that temperature that you want even before it's glowing red. So again, the burners do not need a Liebum Gomer because you're not putting food directly on them.
How does dog kosher microwave oven?
Okay, so a microwave oven, first of all, we do not kosher for Pesach. We also, just because we're different materials that we're not sure of. The way it's brought down to kosher, a microwave oven, is to fill up a, let's say, a styrofoam cup or some plastic utensil with water. You boil it long enough that zea builds up, which is the condensate, so that you can see in the inside of the door, the walls, top, bottom, all the sides are covered with water, and then that's considered a hagala. Just like I mentioned before with grabbing the pliers in the spot, so it's brought down by, when you're koshering this way, you have to do it a second time, but move the cup to a second location, so the place that the cup was initially sitting on will also get koshered. In practical, I've seen microwaves vary from manufacturer to manufacturer, and I've sat there with 20 minutes, you know, adding water and not seeing this great buildup of condensate. So practically, you I'm not very comfortable with it, but as long as you actually see the buildup of the condensate, then that's considered a good hagala. The plastic in an agitator blade, or that you have in factories, is a much stronger and durable plastic. So you're not going to have the problem of dilmachaya shemapaki, that the plastic is going to melt or become deformed in the boiling water. I'm not going to say it will never happen. There are some times where some plastic might. So that problem you won't have. As far as is it a type of material that can be kosher or not, I'm not paskining, but yes, we can. In your own home, if you have a little cheap spatula and it becomes trafe, so most people are knowing just not to kosher and throw it out. But in a factory setting, it's a totally different question. Okay?
Just one more question.
Okay.
Do we have time, Rabbi Grossman, for one question?
Yes.
Sure.
I see it's kosher like Rudaska, our final session here. We're going over.
What is the policy regarding kashering dishwashers?
Are you referring to a dishwasher in a home? Are you talking about a commercial dishwasher?
Both.
Okay. A dishwasher in a home, we usually would not kosher unless it's a stainless steel, a very high-end, expensive dishwasher. That's all the walls are made of stainless steel, so we're not dealing with materials that are problematic. Even then, it's a challenge to get the water up to temperature. It's personally not something that I feel comfortable for. I've done in people's homes these very expensive ones where it was a bigger Shiloh where you can't just get rid of it and get a new one. It was very expensive, and it wasn't koshering from Mama's trait. They moved into a house. They didn't know the level of kosher the person before. So that we have an expression here. I don't know if you have it in Australia, in America. Ask your local Orthodox rabbi. But as far as the home goes, but in a catering in a hotel, and especially for Pesach, it's a major challenge. When I used to do Pesach hotels, or I still do programs in the summer, where I give a hashgacha on a place for 2 weeks at a time. If we go to a hotel for one day for a dinner or wedding, we are not koshering a dishwasher. We're just going to, the caterer will bring the dirty dishes back and wash it in his commissary. The biggest challenge is making sure the dishwasher is clean. You also have to make sure it's not heated by steam that circulates and goes back. Otherwise, you really can't kosher it. Unless you empty the whole boiler, it becomes a whole process, which you could do if you were there for, you know, 2 weeks for Pesach, the time before. Like I said, the challenge is cleaning it. There are different types of dishwashers. Some have a plastic belt that runs through and the dishes sit on that belt. Without removing that belt, it's almost impossible to get into the lower portions of the dishwasher to clean it. Underneath the, usually you have two, three, or four different compartments, and the bottom, that's underneath where they heat up the water. That's actually a kli rishon, and then it will pump that water, you know, and spray it up and below, which then might only be an iri. But to reach those parts, which are a kli rishon, are very difficult. So when I used to kasher for Pesach, I would actually, we would pay to have a company remove this belt, which is a little difficult, more difficult to put it back. And then we were able to clean properly, and I was able to get in to the corners and all the areas with a small blowtorch and burn out any spots and do a libum kal. I happen to own something called a hot water pressure washer, which actually shoots out May Hagala water at 100 degrees. I could adjust it, and I would use that in places that the dishwasher itself wouldn't get up to 100 degrees Celsius. Without that machine, most dishwashers, you don't want it to be too hot, otherwise it'll cook the food onto the plate. So for kashering, you have to call down an engineer or the company that services it. And certain places, they have a booster where you could raise the temperature to boiling. Sometimes it's just a set screw where you could just put in a screwdriver and adjust it yourself. Again, you have to know it is a complicated process, but it can be done, and we will do it. But we will not do it for just one day or one weekend or a smaller job, because of all the work that it entails. Okay. Thank you very much.
Just as we're closing, a few announcements. First of all, my Rebbetzin, who's the Rosh Chodesh sister, says over a story. She works in Or Sameach in Muncie, and she says over where she places people for Yontif, for Shabbos, and she says a story of a recent Baal Tshuva who she had placed for all the meals for Pesach, and he comes to her like Erev Pesach and says, "Ms. Grossman, I thank you very much for placing me, but I got an opportunity and I'm going to be a Mashiach at a hotel." So my Rebbe says she doesn't think that she would eat in that hotel. However, I think from the hour that we've spent, or an hour and 10 minutes we spent with Rabbi Perlmutter, I think everybody would agree that if he was the mashgiach in a hotel, we would feel very comfortable eating there during the whole year, during Pesach as well. I would like to give a big yashar koyach to Rabbi Perlmutter for sharing his expertise with the kollel in Melbourne, Australia. I'd like to thank our technician, Alex Cook, the man behind the scenes here, who has videoed this entire shiur, and it will be also on the Ask OU channel that we have in the OU under Torah and Kosher. We have an Ask OU channel where this shiur will be presented. And we'd like to extend an invitation to the Kollel that, although this is the final shear of this series, but if in the future you have a need on a particular kashrus question that you would like to get some elucidation, we're always here to service you. And I just want to let you know that as a result of the shiurim that we had here, the Skype shiurim, the kollel, We had recently a teacher in Norfolk, Virginia, who would like one of our experts to speak to her class, and we're going to have Rabbi Avi Jurevel speak to, who's one of the biggest kashrus experts around. He'll be speaking about plant kashrus, and the Rabbi Perlmutter says it's Rabbi Jurevel is his Rebbe
in kashrus.
So as a result of this, we have seen that the Skype shiurim, we can really start a global Skype program to service, and we're going to advertise that. I think that both sides of the ocean will agree that it was a tremendous success, the shiurim, based on the feedback that we received. And we're going to offer this to Klal Yisrael wherever they are, as long as they have some Skype connection, we can present to them the experts in the OU. I'd just like to point out that if anyone would like to hear more of Rabbi Perlmutter, he made a fantastic DVD. It's called How to Kasher, and it's available. And I think I will send Rabbi Yisrael Greenwald, who I'd also like to thank, for coordinating everything on his side in Australia. We have many different educational materials that Chavrei HaKoel, I think, will find very beneficial, whether it's DVDs or manuals, publications, and I'll send you that list, and it can be distributed. If anybody wants to order anything, we'll be glad to send it to you. And finally, I don't think you received yet the handouts that Rabbi Perlmutter referred to several times, the temperature handout and the materials, what could be kosher, what not. Rabbi Greenwald will supply that after the shiur. But you, as you'll notice, they are all part of the Daf HaKashrus, and that is a publication that we would make, we would offer it to you. If you want all of the back issues, you can order it on the order form that I'll supply Rabbi Greenwald. But if you just want to sign up, we prefer, of course, Australia, that we sign up with email instead of hard copy. But if anybody sends me their email, we'll be glad to put them on the Daf HaKashrus eDaf list. And my email is Grossman, Grossman, at OU.org, and we thank all of you for participating, and to see the coming of Mashiach Tzakenu. Maybe it'll be over Skype, and we look forward to greeting Mashiach Tzakenu. Thank you very much.
Also, we would like to thank Rabbi Perlmutter on behalf of the Rosh Chayil and Rabbi Nicole and whoever is here today for the phenomenal share, the very informative share which Rabbi Perlmutter gave. Thank you very much. Also, thank you, Mr. Cook, for the filming, the beautiful photography. And also, at this opportunity, we would like to show our Karas HaTayv to Rabbi Grossman. And we made a plaque for Rabbi Grossman, and we also made additional plaques for other members of the OU. And the plaque says, Koilel Beis HaTalmud, Yehuda Fishman Institute, Lakewood Community Koilel of Melbourne, Australia, presented to Rabbi Yosef Grossman, Senior Educational Rabbinic Coordinator, OU Kosher, with deep appreciation for facilitating the 10-part Ask OU Kosher series for our Koil and Broader Melbourne Jewish community, Chaf Gimel Shvat Tavshin Ayin Dalet, Friday, 24th January, 2014, Rabbi Binyamin Wertberger, Rosh Koilel, Rabbi Shaul Gimel, Project Coordinator, and this the virtual version of it, but Rabbi Saffles will be coming to America within the near future. We hope to present you the live copy then.
Thank you very much. And I'll, Mitchem, have it prominently displayed in my office. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. All the best. Good Shabbos.
Shabbos. Welcome.